listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage Regional Originals brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Victor Milana Maog. Victor has directed and developed works at ACT and the Magic Theater in San Francisco, at Hartford Stage, Williamstown Theater Festival, Signature Theater, the Public Theater, Mabu Minds, Working Theater, York Theater, Drury Lane Theater, Connecticut Repertory Theater, INTAR, Mai Yi, Lark, Playwrights Realm, and New Dramatists, among many others. He has an upcoming production of Macbeth at Cal Shakes this summer. From 2016 to 2018, he served as the show director for Disney Parks Live Entertainment. He's an inaugural participant in the Spark Leadership Program and serves as the president of the board of directors of CATA, the Consortium of Asian American Theater Artists. Welcome, Victor. Thanks so much for sitting down with us.
Thank you, Graham. Nice to be sat by.
we're hanging out at the Magic Theater in Fort Mason.
That's right.
Right on the San Francisco Bay. And you're in rehearsals right now for an upcoming production of In Old Age.
That's right, by Infanisa Udofia. It's she's creating a 9-play Nigerian-American cycle, the Ufot family cycle, about Nigerian-Americans and their children. And this is part of this cycle, a world premiere.
And it's kind of an extraordinary moment because you have another production of Emphaniso's playing right now at the Strand Theater at ACT, also in San Francisco. So there's going to be a moment coming up once In Old Age opens where people can see two different episodes from this cycle at the same time or back to back.
It's a remarkable time to actually see two plays that are part of this family saga. What the listeners won't be able to see are the bags under my eyes. Yet the fire in my gut.
You're looking fabulous.
It's very dark where Graham and I are. The lighting is partial and there's fluorescence.
Yeah, we're in a little costume attic at the Magic Theater, which is a room I've actually never been in, but I recognize the costumes from many past productions hanging on these racks behind us.
Yeah, I mean, what's remarkable is even going up to the costume rack, to see the names of John Lyon, Sam Shepard, Taylor Mack, sort of glory comes in all shapes and sizes. And here we are sitting next to a costume rack. And it's amazing.
Yes, it's full of the history of the Magic Theater, which is pretty wild, which now this cycle of plays is a big part of. The first question I'd like to ask you is usually the same starting question. Where did you meet the theater, or where did the theater meet you? How did you find your way into this profession?
Yes. I was born in the Philippines in a period of martial law, military rule, all of those things. And I think I met the theater through the church, through going through the pageantry of the Catholic Church and acting out the passion play with my grandmother and my nanny and probably my dogs. And eventually being able to go through the sort of the Lenten season back from Manila on a boat across some waters to see the passion play sort of enacted out in the provinces. People really carrying the cross, masks all around. And I don't know if this is true, but in the Philippines, there is a history of sort of a true nailing of Jesus to the cross. I don't think that that's necessarily part of my memory, but it would be those sorts of pageants that I would see way back in the day. And then fast forward to moving to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and then meeting theater in Union City, California, blue-collar town in the East Bay. I met a remarkable high school teacher, speech and debate teacher, Tommy Lindsay Jr., who introduced me to coaching, speech and debate coaching, and eventually that brought me into theater directing. And it all started right here, a few miles away.
Wow. Is there a play or a piece of art that changed your life, or kind of like a moment where you saw art that just made you shift the way that you thought about the world and what you were going to do in it?
Yeah, it's a very simple story. I saw a production of Fiddler on the Roof at a high school.
Yes.
In Hayward, California.
Yes, yes.
And it was the first time, I was a freshman, and I'd never really seen anything. My folks didn't go see theater. I mean, we went through the KFC drive-thru is what we did, and that was theater for us.
That was entertainment.
Right. And, of course, Sesame Street and all the things that we could get for low cost.
Yes.
Right. So I was there at Fiddler on the Roof at this high school, and I saw for the first time, and my family had grown up listening to Sound of Music and R&H and all, and you know, my grandmother's hands would dance and all these things would play, and there'd just be enchantments and escapism. And I think it was the first time that I realized that musicals didn't really end happily all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that a certain group of people can express the threads of their life in a story. And so when we hear Anatevka, as they're sort of moving on out because of this occupation that was happening, it absolutely changed the way I thought one can experience the theater. It sort of popped that bubble of pure escape, pure enchantment.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So this season we're focusing on directors who work on new plays, and you have a range of experience, both with the classics and with brand new world premieres. And I wonder if you have a different way of reading a new play than you do of reading a classic, or a different way of approaching as a director putting together a production of a new play than a classic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that very kind bio, right? That overview. I think the thing that is not in any of my bios is that I've slept on many floors in towns that you've probably never heard of. I've directed in Hoopole, North Dakota, population 199. I spent 3 summers in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, running a program. And why do I say all this? For me, it was about meeting all sorts of people in all sorts of different time signature and places and values and trying to find a common thread. Joseph Campbell would call that the monomyth, the one story that connects us all, right? And so for me, this goes way back to all the dinners I've had over people's kitchen tables in parts of places where I've never seen them and they've never seen me. And that's how I begin to approach new plays. How can I find sort of the core and center of a writer beyond sort of there's language and there's ideas, but in each pocket of America that I sort of went to and have and I've been through a lot of glorious and like off the map places, I've been just trying to find that connection of what does that person want? Where do they see their context in the world? And how are they building small figures that are up against this world?
Mm.
The complications of that. And that's what I start to look for in new plays. And more than that, I look for people with the craft, but also the guts to put it forward.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people with guts, and there are people maybe at that moment who don't quite have the guts.
Uh-huh.
And can I be useful? Can I shepherd them ahead? Or am I the totally wrong person for them?
Sure.
Because it's not quite a match.
Yeah,
I hope that begins to answer your question around how I look at new work and how I look at partnerships. Because for me, it's not a one-time deal.
Yes.
It's always a lifetime partnership, hopefully for them and I to unpack and sort of continue a dance across time with each other's work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you think of any examples of how you kind of shepherd or coax or encourage? Like, how do you like to work with a writer as you're developing a new play through, you know, from the first time you read the first draft of the script that's sent to you through to maybe like a world premiere? Are there any examples you can think of you working with a writer to develop a play?
I think it just depends on the writer.
Uh-huh.
Just the way that I work with actors, each is individual. Just like there's different modalities of theater. One of the things I studied at NYU is the performance across the world, performance studies, the anthropological sort of points of view. So there's not just the Stanislavski point of view. There's like Meyerhold, or there's ritualistic things. So I actually look at each person, each creator as an individual, and how can I serve them? So how I might serve a J.T. Rogers is very different than I would serve a Kui Gwen or Mfaniso Udofia.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what I did first with Mfaniso.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
You're in the midst of it.
I'm in the middle of it. And so I was put on this creative blind date with her at the Playwrights Realm.
Awesome.
And so we were on a phone call. I was in L.A., she was in New York back in the day, and she was basically having this first creative download.
Okay.
And I was just blunt about the things I didn't know and understand. And I guess it's sort of now a sort of famous story between us, but she hated my guts.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me more.
And I thought, well, this is going nowhere. There was just things that I didn't understand about her world, and not because maybe it was clear to everybody else.
Yeah.
But for me, where I stood, not knowing the backstory of Biafran war or the Nigerian migration, all of those things weren't clear to me in this text. Well, long story short, it started to work itself out, and we started to understand what each other's point of view was in the lens. But it started out with a bluntness.
Yeah.
And actually, I've been trying to hang on to that for all these years. There's a customer service part of being a stage director.
Yeah.
How do you encourage someone along? How do you make them feel their best? But at the end of the day, I feel like we have to get into rigor.
Yeah.
About clarity and representation of the audience. How do they fit in? Does the audience know and understand how we're jumping into the story? Have we complicated it? Because I work with so many brilliant writers, and they can spin five plates at one time and also, you know, ride a unicycle. That trying to show some sense of like scope and intelligence and panache. And sometimes it just requires simplicity.
Yeah.
And the humility to say, this is that simple story here. And from that sort of essence, whole worlds immerse. So I've been trying to find myself that backbone, just to be blunt enough to go, I don't understand, and to live in that place. And if the writer is not okay with that, then that's okay as well. And I try to find different ways to approach it. And definitely what I try to do is I try to direct every play to the nth degree. I don't come in with a pile of notes saying, this is what's wrong with your play. Here are the things that I definitely need to be addressed. I might have those in my back pocket.
Yeah.
But my job is to inspire the writer by directing to the fullest of their idea some moment of change if it warrants it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's always about pushing the work and the language and all the engines to the fullest intent of the writer, and it inspires us to a next new revision.
Yeah.
That's great. M, in our current production here at the Magic Theater, just gave us a pile of new rewrites just the other day.
Okay.
You know, she had flown in from Hollywood, where she's producing a show.
Yeah.
And she's not known for making rewrites.
Okay.
You know, she has her vision and whatnot, but we had directed it so fully and acted it out so fully that it actually had her contour the play in a major way. So that's the way I like to inspire some sort of change or collaboration.
That's so thrilling. So the next question that I'm really interested in is, like, what is your rehearsal process like? Is there a typical process for you, or is it very different depending on the kind of production that you're doing?
Mm-hmm. I often go with a preface to my creative team and to the staff that the way that I contour a production is dependent on the needs of the production. So, and the way I'm a bit of a method director.
Okay.
Right? So sometimes I'm trying to create an atmosphere where I'm directing the actor in the play, and then sometimes I'm trying to create the experience of the play.
Yes.
With, you know, create this, yes, this tattoo, this imprint within the actors and within the production. And it's sometimes very jarring when folks are looking for the questions of objective, obstacle, action, or here is the particular arc, because it's both working internally within the beats and also giving the experience that I believe the story requires.
Yes.
Right? And depending on the play, it can be quite a wild ride, but I want to feel that the actors have this experience also in their cells. But if I can reduce it,
yeah,
to how do I work in a way, sometimes I will come with a vision to designers, and it needs to be a floating island.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to float in a sense of isolation. I could say those sort of very basic things, or I could work with the idea of what compels me to the play, and the very process of production reveals sort of our investigation. And through this collaboration with the designers, who I also cast for their needs and for their skills and what the production needs. If it needs a sense of scale and a sense of empathy or a sense of magic.
Yes.
I will cast them and then work in counterpoint. So it's not always the same band of designers through.
Right.
And I am quite rigorous with the casting process. I've been known to cast to the very last minute.
Okay.
And refuse lines of actors, because I feel like when I get stuck in a rehearsal process, I need that actor to help me out.
Mm-hmm.
I need them to save my life. Not only do they have to know the basics of craft, but they have to be a dramaturgical actor.
Yes.
For me to fulfill the varied sort of embodiment of the play, and also, frankly, just help us out when we get stuck. So sometimes the audition process can be, with an actor, up to an hour.
Wow.
If I could, I'd do more.
Yeah.
And in that time, I am as clear as I can be in that hour. And in that time, I let myself be as obtuse as I can be in that hour.
Which yes, yes.
Is sadly more often than not. I have no idea what's going on. Sometimes we're speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
But will the actor also have the tolerance to work through the gray zone?
Yeah.
And not just want to be spoon-fed.
Right.
Yeah, I, again, like with the writers, I'm looking for a lifetime collaboration with these actors. And so those are the first steps.
Yeah.
How do I find these designers who have the skill, but also the right panache or dramaturgical elements within their work? And then the actors who can embody it. Because again, I think I'm putting on the stage these American giants.
Yes.
And who can embody splitting hairs and also know how to, the rhetoric of the crowd.
Yes.
And then we go into the rehearsal space. And I let everyone know that we are dramaturgs in this process, especially that first week.
Yeah.
And then we step into what I like to call, some people call it spacing.
Uh-huh.
I call it on your feet table work, where it's okay, where the pictures are, you're on your feet on a tape floor, but the pictures aren't perfect.
Yep.
It's all about relationships only. And we beat it out, we beat it through, and through that process, that's a week-long process of building all the circumstances. The personal text begins to interpolate with the text,
yes,
with the written text, also the community text begins to interpolate. I'm always working in those first 2 weeks, the table work and the on your feet table,
yes,
work, which always baffles people on rehearsal reports. We're working on what's written, our personal connection, our personal text, and the community. What does it mean at this time to a city like San Francisco?
Okay,
or
that's
Chicago,
what you mean by community.
Right.
Great.
And the communities all around. And then what we'll do is move through spacing, and you know, we begin to stage quite dynamically, you know, within a few inches of the actor's life. And I also will say, if the actor cannot remember my staging,
yeah,
I throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like then it is not fully fulfilling the arc and the momentum needed in the scene.
Yes. I'm curious about how you talk about this community idea in the midst of a creative process. Could you provide an example from, like, Her Portmanteau or from In Old Age of how this story is connected to San Francisco at the moment?
Mm-hmm. I zoom out quite a bit. What you'll hear in my work is an element of zooming into the play and out of the play to look in and above the play and around the play. I let them know I grew up in the East Bay, Union City. And for me, I never thought I would be able to go from Logan High School to work at this sort of castle on a hill. This idea of a Nigerian-American story as directed by a Filipino-American, I contextualize what that is and the sort of brave, bold moves that Pam McKinnon is doing in her inaugural season.
Yes.
And then I also contextualize the sense that this is an interplay with Lauren Yee's Great Leap, the first time on the main stage a Chinese-American is played in San Francisco, right? I also try to name that in the 50 or so years of ACT, I believe I've only been the second Asian director to direct on a main stage. And the first one to direct a piece that was not specifically Asian. So we take those stories into play.
That's great.
And we also then start to talk about the breadth of what does it mean, African works, African American works, and how do we tackle work that Empedocles is writing that she never thought would be produced. She wrote this 9-play cycle, a Nigerian-American cycle. She didn't do it in partnership with a mainstream, predominantly white theater. She thought it would be just for her. So we have insisted that the audiences, mainstream, you name any demographic, have to lean into the play.
Yeah.
And we are not presenting a play. We're not pandering in any way. And so some folks in the audience of many different communities might feel uncomfortable and might feel new. There is a whole bed of this dialect of Ibibio, about 25% of the play.
Yeah.
I refuse to put super titles in because I didn't want that release. I wanted the audiences and the theater to understand the story of otherness.
Yeah.
Of dislocation.
And we've got to lean in.
And our audiences have to lean in and understand that whoever's next to us at the supermarket, whoever we might think, you know, whatever stories we have, has this sort of depth and complexity. So those are the ways that I begin to frame the story and get the audiences sort of closer to this campfire.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I'd love to ask you about A Total Catastrophe, mostly because Total Catastrophe stories are pretty funny. But I think it's also important to, you know, as directors that, you know, things don't always go perfectly. And I think the things that we learn from our total catastrophes are awesome. At least they have been for me. Mm-hmm. Has there been an event that's just kind of not worked out the way that you've wanted it to, that you've taken away something from?
This podcast is not long enough.
It's be a bonus podcast.
And the producers will go, you know, we actually shouldn't ever hire him, really. You know, I can only say some of these victories because I've had so many. It's just embarrassing, really, you know, from the way that I've treated actors. You know, back in the day, I don't know if there are total catastrophes because I've probably blocked them out.
Okay. I'm sure they weren't that bad.
Well, you know, back in the day, like 20 years ago when I was first directing here in the Bay Area running a program, I would have an unbelievable temper.
Okay.
The sort of temper where I, you know, I don't know why I'm saying this now on this podcast. The sort of temper that just is frightening.
That's so amazing because you're the chillest person I've ever met. Right.
So, yeah, the sort of catastrophe where I would, this sounds horrible now. What, you know, that temper would come in and, you know, for my dramatic value, you know, throw a chair across the room.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And belittle actors and tell everybody exactly what they needed to do. There was no room for collaboration. Right? Now it seems like I'm chill and, you know, and there's a hookah near us.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah,
we're having the time of our lives. But that was, for me, a personal rewrite.
What turned that around? Like, where? How did you figure out that that wasn't something that was working?
I think I had some success, some early success. I ran I was directing and ran a government program that won a presidential award at age 20, and this was a big thing that was, you know, big musicals, Music Man, Damn Yankees, outdoors, rock and roll lighting
okay,
in
yes.
front of thousands of folks and things like that. So that can get to your head
sure.
easily. And what I started to do, what I started to realize is I was living in my own island. And you know, theater can be filled with, you know, all these fiefdoms.
Yeah.
Demanding this and that. And I started to realize that people weren't working with me again.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so what I also started to realize is that my need to have the total control destroyed any empathy, any care for where writers were in their process. Most of the writers, many who I've grown up with, have become some of, you know, our nation's greatest writers in many, multiple mediums.
Yeah.
But I'm starting to realize as I've written, like, my one sole play.
Yes.
And I did that as an exercise to, actually, as an exercise in can I do it, but as an exercise in empathy.
And this was for Theater Move.
This was for Theater Move. It was a commission and eventually fully produced. It was called Tot, the... Tots of wrestling play. I can't even remember the title at this point.
Yeah.
But it was about stepping in and understanding, will the writer have the capacity to answer this deeply personal question about themselves and this work and these characters at this time? And oftentimes, many years ago, I would only adhere to a deadline. Well, it's due on Thursday. We said that's when it's due, when actually it is a deeper sort of work that they have to dive into be able to unpack whether it's a family story or these, you know, larger societal issues. Because sometimes there are things we're afraid of, blockages, things we're afraid to reveal to ourselves in the way that I'm sure O'Neill had.
Yeah, yeah.
And many of our great writers write from a personal point, whether it's direct or indirect. And it's hard to sort of put that on a very short timeline of deliverables.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I've tried to put the human value forward and understand that it might take a bit more time. So that's sort of a long and short answer to some of the many mistakes I've made, both like in sort of the temperament, but also the care for what it means to grow and develop a relationship.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think it's so important to recognize, you know, the full trajectory of our growth as artists. And, you know, it's a kind of profound privilege in our profession that, you know, we can just keep working on whatever it is for our whole careers.
Yeah, and it's easy to be friends with somebody when they're Hamlet.
Yeah.
And so I made a decision long ago that I was going to be someone's friend and colleague when they're Hamlet, when they're a barista at Starbucks, not only when they're just useful to me.
Yeah.
Because the way that our structure is, it is a dash and go structure.
Yeah.
Where you're meant to eject yourself out of every seat. And so you don't see sort of the bodies in our wake.
Yeah.
Right. And I want to change that personally and understand that we're part of a constellation. Maybe we're not geographical for these, we're geographical community for these 3 to 5 weeks, but we're actually a spiritual community that grows together and expands together and needs each other and will re-meet again. That's always my hope, that we re-meet again in whatever iteration that needs to be.
Yeah. Do you find that this is a program that's dedicated to the work of directors who work in the regions and how the regional theater in this country maybe feels different or is not quite the same as the New York market? Do you find that this idea of the holistic vision that you just really beautifully described exists more in one of those places or another? Do you find it's easier to fulfill this kind of value statement when you're working in the regions?
It depends on who's in charge.
Yeah.
We just have to put these values front and center. Listen, I've worked for large corporate, entities.
Yeah.
So I also understand about transaction and marketing and all those things, and which, by the way, very useful.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to
take a great skill set.
Take some of those knowledges and superpowers and put them into the stories that were in the margins and put them center stage.
Yeah.
To your question, where does this exist? This value system? It exists in leaders.
Yeah.
And folks who have the strength and the vision to know that all these decisions are in every pore of the organization, from how you treat the box office and how the box office treats subscribers and or new people.
Yeah.
And to how they handle complaints around the dialect and how there's no subtitles. It begins from all those points of view. And so one of the things that I think we just have to make it a priority in this, sort of large, small market that is theater.
Yes.
Right? Oftentimes one of the reasons why I do educational programs and training programs is because, let me just be honest. I was beat down for a while. I was beat down with what I thought was a classist system and, a system that if you didn't go to X school, you're out. If you didn't have X money and could subsidize this whole life, you're out. If, you had to look this way or that way. And it was brutal on me. So one of the things that I've really kept close to me is because of my start in being mentored in high school. And by the way, the speech and debate teacher who helped mentor me, years later, I opened up the New York Times, became a MacArthur genius.
Get out of town.
For the thousands of students that he bought their first suits for, helped shepherd them to national championships in speech and debate. He was on Oprah. There's a documentary on him. But he was just the gentleman.
Right.
It's like we don't know who's
right
near us. He was the first African-American valedictorian at USF.
Uh-huh.
But he was just the gentleman who paid for my fees, but also paid for my Sizzler meals. And I just thought he was a nice teacher. But he was teaching me values and helping build a group of people who would go on to be lawyers and broadcasters and, I guess, theater directors too.
Yeah.
Right, who would tell these stories. And I think that's what I'm interested in education, because I needed to work with a group of people and impart some values around collaboration, the sense of ensemble, and the sense of social responsibility.
Yeah.
And so that now, as I've stepped away from some of the training programs, some of these students, if I may boast, are just doing remarkable work. They're above the title. They have their own TV shows. There was a point, actually, now, while I'm at the Strand, I've had two former students, one in Hello Dolly, one in Hamilton, performing. I have a commissioned writer who was simultaneously now working in Hollywood, but was in the Roof Theater.
Yeah.
I have former faculty who is now the artistic director at Cal Shakes. So when we build this world together and we sort of reveal what's important besides just the craftsmanship and the wow, yes, and sort of the entertainment value, but the entertainment of like the heart and what we can do when we have a spine.
Yes.
It's been delightful. And I think that's probably why I can speak to you with a little bit more breath today.
Yeah.
As these wonderful folks are doing this work with what I believe are values forward. But it takes leadership and it takes an investment in that. I turned down some more prominent things to invest in training and building a artistic learning community. But I guess I never knew it would turn out this way, but I could tell you it's pretty good today.
That's fabulous. Is there, I mean, what you're talking about is so inspiring, and I just wonder, you know, every house that you walk into when you are offered an opportunity at a theater, how do you determine how your value system that you've expressed can operate within the leadership or the culture of the theater that you've been in? Because, you know, we only get to stay for like 3.5, 4.5 weeks. And how do you make a space during that brief amount of time that reflects your values within a different set of values or within a larger culture that's been around from well before your rehearsal started and will be around well after?
Well, how do I create a space that sticks around?
Yeah, yeah. That's probably the better question.
I don't know, Graham. I don't propose to be that impactful.
Okay.
Right. I don't think I'm the Messiah. I think I'm good. but I'm there just for a few weeks. But what does it mean for me?
Or maybe how do you ask for what you need?
Again, what they will see when I go into a room is that there is a relationship that I have with my assistants where I actually value their opinions. When we go around the round tables, which can be quite hierarchical.
Yeah.
I value feedback.
Yeah.
There is a rapport that I have with folks who work in the kitchen and the front door. And for me, that's just normal.
Yeah.
Right? I've done those sorts of jobs. And so I understand that they help create the greatness of the show in the same way that I always ask my leads to help lift up the spear carriers of the play, that's also their job.
Yeah.
To not only play Macbeth, but to lift up the whole company. And hopefully just through this modeling and maybe a really great show because of it, because of personal stake and all the shareholders.
Yes.
That they'll see, even if it's like a 1 or 2 degree expansion.
Yes.
Because we can't ask for anything radical, because it's also like shocking and oddly unrealistic.
Yes.
If we can go in 1 or 2 degrees, that there is slightly more collaboration, that there is a sense that we can talk about the entirety of a play instead of being siloed into one department and a sense of just servitude.
Yeah.
Then that's success.
Yes.
That's success for me. And luckily, some of my shows have done really well critically, and the box office has been good, and my track record has been good. So all those, the numbers and the stats, add up as well.
Yes.
If that makes sense. So I know that it has to be of the highest artistic quality for them to go to know and understand that this way of working also delivers.
Yes.
Delivers the goods. Okay.
Yeah. So I think we just have time for one more question. And the question that I love finishing with is about kind of like a wish for the American theater. And sometimes I've talked about this wish as like, you know, we kind of have one way of making theater in this country where you get 4 weeks of rehearsal and then it runs for a month and a half in our regional theaters. But if you had any wish Like, let's say we're like writing a letter to a foundation or something of a new initiative that might really change the game. Is there one wish that you have for how we might do something differently that we could look forward to, or like, you know, send to a foundation that might be able to help achieve this wish?
Having worked in many facets of the theater, both on the main stage and in education and in community engagement, I know that there is and should be a relationship across the theater. Oftentimes, and there's a lot of movement now about community engagement, audience development, all those things, but sometimes I think it's true. People really do want to engage. And then sometimes it's really a marketing lens.
Yeah.
And let's just name what that is. And that's not bad. It's just, if we're thinking in a holistic way, I would propose that there be a relationship between the brightest platform, which is the main stage, which has been historically the sort of like the brass ring, right?
Yeah.
And the folks who work in the education work. I did a lot of teaching artist work in New York City. I worked in every borough. And those kids probably didn't give a rat's ass that I was working with Marion Seldes at the Public the very next day.
Yeah.
And I think if you work in a space that is just completely elite, it's easy to create a bubble. So I guess what I'm proposing is a way to create a blend, but also popping our own preconceived bubbles.
Yeah.
Right? There's bubbles all across the country. The bubble of a major regional theater, the bubble of whatever that project I was doing in Hoopole, North Dakota, population 199. And how do we start to create some intersectionality and a scaffolded and sort of really planned way of bridging socioeconomic elements in the theater? And I think one would really feed the other.
That's so beautiful. What a great vision and wish for the future of our work. So, do you have any shows coming up before we say goodbye that that our listeners can come check out in the coming months?
I don't recall exactly when this goes up, but
yeah, I think it should probably be. It's so funny that we're just guessing, but obviously the people listening will be knowing when it is. But I think this will go up probably in late March. Or early April.
Oh, late March. So you can actually catch the Lord premiere of Emphanice Odofia's Her Portmanteau at American Conservatory Theater, runs through March 31st. It's really a wonderful first-class production.
Yes, it is. I just saw it the other night, and it's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's great to be part of Pam McKinnon's first season. And simultaneously, we're now in rehearsals about to head into the world premiere of Enfinisos in Old Age here at the Magic Theater that runs from March 27th through April 21st. So there's a whole week where you actually see two related but separate parts of her cycle.
Yes.
So M and I are the same. The only crossover. We have separate teams, separate budgets, everything. It's, you know, that is its own wonderful dance. And then if you look to the end of the summer, I get to do the season closer for Cal Shakes. I'm doing Macbeth there. And we have that opens in September and runs through October. And I cannot wait to be under the stars again. I never thought I would be at Cal Shakes. But Eric Ting has made that possible and made a lot of things possible for a lot of folks. So I'm thrilled about that.
That's so fascinating. Thank you so much for sitting down today. It's been an awesome conversation.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you for this.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.